Welcome back to University of Minnesota Extension's Nutrient Management Podcast. I'm your host, Paul McDivitt, Communications Specialist here at U of M Extension. Today on the podcast, we're talking about fall soil sampling. We have three members of Extension's Nutrient Management Team, Dan Kaiser, Fabian Fernandez, and Melissa Wilson. Can you each give us a quick introduction?
Hi, I'm Melissa Wilson. I focus on manure management.
This is Dan Kaiser. I'm on the St. Paul campus. My focus is on fertilizer management, and one area that I work a lot on is soil testing.
Fabian Fernandez, also in the St. Paul campus. I'm a nutrient management specialist and extension specialist in nitrogen management and water quality.
All right, starting off, is there a best time to take soil samples in the fall?
Well, I think, I mean, looking at this fall, it's mostly, can you get back, can you get in? I mean, getting in... With fall sampling, really, I think it's important to try to get in before fertilizer application into the last two falls. Maybe some fields out there that were intended to be sampled that may not have been sampled just because it was came down to, you know, getting the fertilizer on and just not enough time. So I think that's the main thing is looking at, you know, what's feasible. Certainly, it's better to have the data ahead of time because really, if you're looking at a soil test, you really want to have those numbers in hand to know what's the best strategy for specific areas of the field. And I do get this question every once in a while, sampling after fertilizer application. And I don't know if there's really a good answer at that, whether or not you can sample. I wouldn't do directly after application. So if you did apply in the fall, I wouldn't go back out and take samples in the fall. Spring or summer probably would be a better option. And that's one of the things I'm looking at right now. You've got some studies looking at fall and spring application of phosphorus, and we took some samples in June, and it's interesting, you look at that data, how much different the soil test increase is for the fall versus spring sampling in June, and you can see soon after application, you really want to avoid, you know, you need to give the time, the fertilizer time to react, and it's really better to take it after the crop has been taken off, or at least give it a few months to sit there. So, I mean, I think it really depends on the situation. I mean, certainly, again, we see a lot of emphasis, particularly in small grain fields, of getting out there after the combine, which we kind of like to wait on some things. But when it comes down to it, again, it's better to have that data than not have that data when you're trying to make decisions on what to do in the fall.
Yeah, and, you know, I work primarily with nitrogen now, but in my previous life at a different university, I worked a lot on P and K, and one of the things with phosphorus is not too much of a concern when you take the soil samples. I agree with Dan that you don't want to take soil samples if you already apply fertilizers, but with phosphorus, it's not too much of an issue because it's fairly constant. Potassium tends to be a lot more variable, and it kind of has a cyclic nature on when you take those soil samples. And so if you go right after harvest, and the values tend to be a little bit lower, and then as the fall progresses, those values start to get up a little bit higher because potassium starts to leach out of the plant material into the soil. And then in the spring, again, the values tend to be higher. If you wait until like about June, those values start to go down. And then obviously if you take samples when the plants are really taking up a lot of potassium, the values get really low. So you don't want to go into the extremes. And so trying to be kind of in the middle of the fall, you know, let it sit for a while after harvest. And then if not in the spring, around June time, is probably, I would say, the best time to take those soil samples.
Yeah, and I think we've seen some movement towards taking samples in June, and particularly in soybean fields, and that's not necessarily a bad thing just because of what Fabian was saying. And what I typically stress to a lot of growers and consultants is when you're looking at taking samples, is that, particularly for potassium, as Fabian said, we see a lot of cyclical, I mean, it looks kind of like a wave if you look at the soil test over time, as if you look at some of the data, that it's best to be consistent, particularly if you're trying to track your fertility program and see what's happening over time. And I think you see some issues in some years with switching, particularly from fall to spring, that you'll get some drops and or some increases in values. And particularly with the drops, you know, you get a lot of concern, I know, from growers seeing or worrying that, you know, either their program they've come up with or, you know, who they're working with is they're seeing their fertility going down, and a lot of it's just the cyclical nature of what's going on. I mean, we do see it somewhat with phosphorus. We do tend to see some years where the soil test drops a little bit farther, but typically, if you look at it long-term averages, the soil test shouldn't change more than about 2 parts per million a year if you don't apply phosphorus, and that's the Bray phosphorus long-term. But you'll see some up and down with it, and it's
unless you're really high on phosphorus, and then you can see a
A big drop. Yeah, I've seen situations where we're in Swaminard ground. One of the studies I had when I was doing my master's, I think we started around 80, 90 part per million, and within a couple of years, it dropped about 50 part per million. And that's just the nature of feed the beast. When you get that high, you really need a lot of phosphorus to keep those soil tests up that high. So it's really, though, when you get around the I would say the more critical range, you get around, say, 30 part per million phosphorus. I mean, it shouldn't drop that much on a year-to-year basis. And it's more worrisome you get more in the medium range, because in a couple of years, then you switch ranges, you start seeing ranges drop. But overall, it's one of those things that with sampling, you know, just try to be consistent as much as possible and sample as frequently as possible. I mean, I know there's definitely a lot of opinions on how often you need to sample. I don't think there's one good answer. It just really depends on the field and how tightly you're trying to manage your nutrients.
With manure application, we definitely kind of say the same thing. You should try to sample before you get manure applied. Especially with manure, we're dealing with not only the inorganic portion of the nutrients, but also the organic portion. So if you have gotten manure out and haven't soil sampled, it's probably best just to wait until the next year before you get the manure on. I think, Dan, you were saying maybe even June would be the earliest you'd potentially soil sample in a manured system.
Yeah, and you know, in my previous life too, and one of the things I did work on was poultry litter, and we were doing some sampling when we had fall or spring applications. I mean, it wasn't consistent. We just did vary by site, but we went back in and sampled in June. What I was working on was a phosphorus study, and we saw some pretty significant spikes in the soil test for phosphorus. And if you're already in a high classification, it's probably not that big of a deal. If you need exact numbers, though, if you're trying to manage things for, say, water quality or for some sort of phosphorus management plan, then you probably need to be a little bit more careful because you'll end up with higher values, which would probably it's over more limit what you can do in some areas. So that's one of the things I think to with fertilizer, we know it does react quicker and it's more readily available. But manure, it's a bigger question mark, as Melissa was saying.
Yeah, we know that there's regulations in the state too. You, within 300 feet of a water body, you can only have so high of phosphorus levels before you start being regulated on what you can apply in those areas. So that's always a good place to make sure you're keeping your regular consistent soil samples too. I think they say in the regulations it has to be every 4 years at a minimum, but that might be area if you're up high already, you might want to actually do it a little more often just to see what's going on in those fields.
I just want to come back for a second to the frequency of soil sampling and the changes that we can see over time. Again, phosphorus tends to be a lot more stable than potassium, but it is very important to really look at test values over time, look at the trend, whether it's going down, staying about the same, or going up. Don't focus too much on changes that sometimes you might see from sampling to sampling, because there are a lot of things that could influence those concentrations, and so you really have to kind of take a long view to these trends and seeing where you are at.
Yeah, I think it depends in manured systems too. How often are you manuring? What types of manure are you using? Like poultry litter tends to be really high in phosphorus and potassium, versus something like a more dilute dairy manure isn't going to have as high a concentrations.
Yeah, and one of the things, you know, Fabian, you kind of, you know, mentioned some of that up and down and that yearly and how often you have to sample. And you know, certainly it is interesting looking at that. Potassium, I think, is one of the main ones that we do tend to see some bigger swings with. And that a lot of that has to do with the residue. We have a lot of potassium in the residue. I think phosphorus can be somewhat affected in some years. I think that's why we tend to see some bigger dips in some years. Maybe that I haven't been able to prove it, but we don't have a lot of phosphorus in the residue. But I think some years we might see some higher values that might bring the soil test down, but then we always tend to see after those where it drops, we tend to see a bigger spike. So again, you look at the average over time, it remains pretty constant. So Potassium's, I mean, potassium's a big one when you start talking about it and taking samples. I mean, you just kind of have to, again, just stick with a consistency and whatever you can do. It's better having a number than not having a number. But if I look at all my data, spring sampling or June sampling tends to work for, seems to work better for potassium. It's more stable over time.
And part of the reason for that is the residue part that, you know, it has released by then. But the other part, too, is the freezing and thaw cycles that we have through the fall, winter, and spring that also influence the release and the fixation of potassium in the soil. And so by June, everything kind of has kind of come to an equilibrium at that point, and so you tend to see more consistency at that point.
And the other thing to look at too is with sampling is, you know, we look at this year getting cold and seeing the soil start to kind of, the water start to freeze up a little bit, is really getting a good sample is the other thing too. Is, I mean, when you start looking at colder soils, I mean, it becomes pretty difficult to, I think, to get the adequate depth what you want to do, and certainly wet soils too. I mean, that's the thing we seem to be fighting against the last couple of years is getting some good samples. And I was out recently in one field and it was just miserable. I mean, it wasn't overly wet where we couldn't walk in there, but it was just gummy enough in there where it's just difficult to take it and get a good sample. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors in there in terms of taking a sample. And I mean, I kind of just boil down to just, you know, if as long as you can get a good sampling depth with what you're doing, and you at least can try to get the sample before fertilizer application, that's really the best you can do. And just try to be consistent with the field over time to be able to track your trends is really better than anything else.
What's a good strategy for sampling banded fields?
And that's that's a really important one, too. That's where you take the soil sample really makes a difference. And so we actually have done a pretty intensive soil sampling study looking at different positions with respect to the row or where the band, the fertilizer band was applied. And what we found was that you need to take for every core that you take on the fertilizer band, you had to take at least two or three cores outside of that fertilizer band and then composite that and repeat that process, you know, two or three times into a composite of you know, several cores, 12 cores or so, to get a good representation of what's going on with the fertility. If you sample too much in the band, what you will end up with is a number that is much higher than what you actually have in the field. So you will be led to believe that you have more fertility than you actually have. And that can be problematic if you are kind of close to deficiency ranges where you may actually be dipping into an insufficiency situation. The opposite is true. If you only sample outside of that fertilizer band, your soil test values will be much lower, and so you will end up creating a situation where, well, you actually have more fertility than what your soil test value is telling you, and you can end up applying fertilizer that you don't really need. And so those are the important things. And you know, the situation is, well, what if you don't know where that fertilizer band is? Then keeping kind of a consistent distance between the samples, at some point you will hit that fertilizer band. And so if you repeat that operation 3-4 times for each sample that you composite sample that you collect, you will be certain to hit that fertilizer band and account for that higher fertility that you have in the fertilizer band.
And one of the things too that I've always kind of wondered is, you know, what's the best option when it comes to a banded strategy? Do you band in the same spot with RTK? I mean, that's certainly a viable option where you can get pretty close within maybe an inch of that same band and just repeatedly band, or do you move that band around? I think there's a lot of opinions on that, and I think that brings in more questions on sampling. I mean, historically, ridge till, I mean, we had some of that going on. That's been, you know, a number of years ago, and I think there's still some growers doing that, and they're better. When we start looking at the data, we've had, I think, much better data looking at that band, particularly here in Minnesota. I know the work you're talking about was stuff you did in Illinois, but I think it's certainly true here in Minnesota as well. But ridge tillers, I know that's one of the things that, talking to some consultants, that some things have come up with people other people sampling some of those fields and not sampling correctly, and then going to those growers and saying, hey, you know, look how poor this management is when it may not necessarily be that way just because they're not sampling correctly, not taking the correct amounts from the band and then within the bands as well. So it's, you know, that's kind of a good question in terms of, you know, management. Is it better off just to know where that band is if you know it every year? How does those older bands affect things that, I mean, it's, you never really know.
And, you know, typically agronomically, if you have adequate fertility, it really doesn't matter if you're banding the fertilizer or broadcasting the fertilizer. The important thing is that you have adequate amounts of the nutrient present. And so with the fertilizer band, that question comes often, you know, whether to keep the fertilizer band in the same spot or changing it. And it kind of depends. Is your preference, really. Having it always in the same place can create a situation where you have controlled traffic, which may be advantageous, but, you know, moving it around could also be good so that you don't concentrate all your fertility in a very small portion of the soil volume. The one thing that I mentioned is that when you're banding the fertilizer, you know, 6 inches below the surface or 4 inches below the surface, the plants, as they take nutrients, they also take water, and you can end up with a pretty dry, concentrated fertilizer band in there. And then when you have a small rain events, you may get more rewetting of the surface and not so much where you have that concentrated fertility. So in a way, you're kind of putting all the fertility, all those eggs in one basket, as you will. And so it's better, in my opinion, to, if you, you know, spread that a little bit more, whether it's a broadcast application or moving that fertilizer band. The other thing that we learned from that study that we did in Illinois was that even if you are broadcast fertilizing, if you're broadcasting your fertilizer, if you are using RTK and planting always in the same position, you will actually end up with a banded situation for potassium. Like we were talking earlier, potassium leaches out of the plant material. Once the plants are at R6, the potassium that is in the above ground portions, in the roots, it starts to leach out. And so we found through the soil sampling that we were doing, even though we were broadcasting the fertilizer and everything should have been uniform across the field, we found that the row position was much higher than the between row position, simply because we were always planting in that same position and all that fertilizer that, or a lot of that fertilizer that was in the plant material, was basically depositing itself in that row. And so in those situations, if you're using RTK, always planting in the same position, you would kind of want to treat that field as you would with a banded fertilizer application.
All right, grid versus zone sampling, which is the better option?
This is, I think, the everlasting question, always with it when it comes to fields. And really, to me, it depends on the field. I mean, it depends on the situation, depends on how high your soil tests are. I mean, if you're manured, it might be a little bit different strategy versus maybe a rented piece of ground that you've got to buy the fertilizer for. So it really depends. It really depends on the variability you have out there, because the issue we have, even with some of the denser grid sampling, is that you can have about as much variation within some grids as you could have across the field with the soil test values. So it's really knowing your field and knowing ways that you can evaluate your sampling strategies is really, I think, what would be optimal to me. Is if you're going into a new field to be doing a very dense grid, then maybe looking at, if you have consistency of those grids, to break them out into various zones to maybe reduce a little bit on the sampling. But you know, really, grid zone, I mean, I don't think there's a best option in there. One of the big things to watch out, I think, on those is the number of subsamples within those particular areas that you need to have, because I think we see some tendency to go with less or fewer subsamples, which can cause issues. We know that the fewer the samples you're taking within a composite sample, the higher likelihood that we have, that we know that the more uncertainty we have, plus or minus, from what the true soil test with that average is. And I know there's been some work looking at that, and you get to above a certain point, there's really no reason to go above that, but below a certain point, we know that it tends to be more uncertainty. So with fields, it really just really depends on, I think, knowing what field, knowing what the soil test values are, because certainly with the higher soil test value, if that's consistent across the field, you probably don't need to worry about taking too many samples. Maybe in a manured situation, if you need to know certain soil tests, if you're close to water bodies, that you're going to want to try to sample those separately, and fields too, if you know there was maybe an old livestock yard or where all the manure historically was dumped. Sometimes we see that still showing up today, even if it was 30 years or more years ago where those things were at. So
sometimes even where something has been stockpiled all year long, like chicken litter or something like that, might be a hot spot too. So just kind of keeping an eye on those over time is good.
Yeah, and I really don't have anything more to add than what has been said. I mean, the main thing is kind of a strategy. As Dan mentioned, my suggestion would be, if you don't know the field, do an intense grid sampling, and then to reduce the amount of labor and cost, once you know that, then you can figure out where to make zones based on the previous information and landscape, past use, and things like that, information like that.
I mean, it certainly breaks down to time and money. I mean, really, you look at it, though, the soil testing, I mean, we've seen cost increases, we've seen some other things, but you look at it, it's still pretty cheap, particularly if you have field areas that you're over-applying and that you could cut back a little bit, and that's really where we're looking at trying to do is save just a little bit of cost here to try to make things profitable. And so it's not a bad option to look at that, and if you haven't grid sampled, you know, it might be a good time, but like I said, I think it's going into a field early on, so you kind of know that variability, and then you've got other tools like yield maps to go in and look and see, and maybe there's something performing poorly in areas of the field. Is that soil related? Is it related to drainage? Is it related to something else to see, kind of effectively fix that? But, you know, certainly some options that people have out there. I think, again, with higher soil test values, particularly with phosphorus, you know, maybe one sample every 10 acres. And I don't know if there's any, is there any sort of rules of thumb with manure fields, what they usually recommend for stuff with manure management plans for the number of samples per field?
For the state plans that you have to do for permits, they just want a field average. So if you do the grid sampling, you're still eventually going to get just a soil phosphorus average. The big thing that we recommend, though, is if you are, say you have high soil tests, but you also have a zone that's near a water body, so that 300 feet, you might actually want to split that out into a second zone and kind of treat it as a second field in the yield or in the manure management planner for the state, just because that would then give you more things that you can do in those two different fields. Like maybe you wouldn't apply more manure in that 300 feet, but you could still apply manure to the area 300 feet away from the stream, even if it does have like high phosphorus levels. But we do get to the certain, there's a certain level that I think it's 150 parts per million Bray-P where you still might be regulated in what you can do in those fields, even if it is 300 feet in a way.
And that's where I'd be careful. You get into some of those high situations, that's when you probably would want to break your field apart a little bit more, because you may have just hot spots in there that are worse than others. So maybe a little less limiting in terms of what you can do if you've got more information out there showing that certain areas of the field are lower where you could put more fertilizer on. But
and especially in manure situations, you want to know where you can put manure on and where you can't.
Yeah, and well, I think it was touched on, but you know, the importance of how many cores go into that sample is very important. When we go into grid sampling or zone sampling, the temptation is, or the thought is, okay, if I have more soil test values, that's better information than having fewer soil test values for a particular field or zone. And in reality, what happens is people tend to skimp on the number of cores that go into a composite to take more samples. And in reality, the better information is actually to have fewer samples with more cores in that composite. So that's very important. And if I may, one more thing that just coming back to the band applications, something that is very important that I didn't mention is that the sampling depth is really important. You know, how deep are you applying those fertilizers? If you're applying them, you know, 8 inches deep or something, you're taking a 6-inch core, which is what we recommend for sampling depth, you will still not be tapping into that hot spot of fertilizer band. So taking the samples that account for that application depth is very important.
Yeah, I know talking to some consultants, the one thing they like to do is try to geo-reference where they're taking their cores from, and some, particularly within zones, and try to come back to maybe half of those spots the next year, and then do maybe some new areas the year after that. And it's not really a good way, I think, to do it. It's certainly probably better than just taking one sample or core from the midpoint, and that becomes, I think, a bigger issue with sampling. If you're just taking, you know, one point from that midpoint, is that representative of what that's within that whole field? If you certainly maybe have a smaller sampling, you know, like we do with our small plots, I think I'd have more confidence. But even within our small plots, you can see some variation from one part of the plot to the next. So that's the thing is, you know, I think it's around 15 or so kind of is the upper limit. If you look at that beyond that, you get really diminishing returns.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if you're below that, I mean, you're looking at maybe taking six cores. I mean, we could be plus or minus 2-3 part per million with the phosphorus. And, you know, if you're kind of on the edge of a medium or low, then what do you do? Do you just assume maybe that you're a little bit lower and apply accordingly? Or what do you do? I mean, it's a good question. And that's one of the things that... taking more cores is better, but we know that it's always not as feasible and trying to get a lot of stuff done. But
all right, that about does it for the podcast this week. We'd like to thank the Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council, AFRAC, for supporting this podcast. If you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also find out about new podcast episodes, as well as our blog posts and videos, by subscribing to Minnesota Crop News email alerts. Just Google Minnesota Crop News and click Get Minnesota Crop News by email at the top of the homepage. And be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at UMN Nutrient MGMT. Thanks for listening.